An Osho Talk. From Unconsciousness to Consciousness, number 28.
What do you think of Moses' Ten Commandments? Do you have any commandments for us?
Moses is one of the most charismatic leaders that the world has known. But he is not a religious man. He is a lawgiver. But to be a lawgiver is one thing, and to be religious is totally different. He decides what is right, what is wrong for his people. But right and wrong are not eternal things. Something is right this moment, and the next moment it is not right. Something is right in one context, in another context it becomes just its opposite. Laws are dead. Once you have decided them, then they are fixed. They don't change with the context, with the situation, with the time. They cannot change. They are not living beings. Moses guided his people out of slavery. Gave them great hope for the future. Inspired them. But he could not make them religious. Because he could not make them religious, he had to substitute religion by laws. Laws are poor substitutes for consciousness. But when consciousness is missing, there is nothing else to do except to give laws and follow the laws. Why Moses could not make his people religious? He himself was not a religious person. His encounter with God is nothing but a hallucination. God exists not. So those who have encountered God have encountered their own imagination, wandering in the hot, burning, fiery desert for years, hungry, thirsty, his people dying, their hope dying. There seems to be no end to this. Search for the promised land. He goes to the mountains. To think, to contemplate, to pray to God. He must have been in a hopeless situation. Now the people were asking, and there was no answer. They were asking, where is the promised land? It seems you don't have any idea where it is. You uprooted us. Of course we were a slave, but at least we were surviving. Now we are dying. People choose a slavery for the simple reason, if the alternative is death, then it is better to be a slave. At least you are alive and there is a possibility someday you may get out of the slavery. But when you are dead, the possibility disappears. So it is not wrong to choose a slavery when it is an alternative to death. Moses brought these people out of slavery. Giving them all kinds of dreams, and slowly those dreams started turning into desert dust. Days went by, months went by, years went by, and people were dying as they have never seen people dying. 40 years he was wandering in the desert of Middle East. In 40 years, out of 3 persons, 2 persons had died. 2/3 of the original people are no more there. And those who have remained, you cannot call them alive either. These 40 years have been such a suffering that it would have been a lot better if they had died. They were skeletons. Naturally, Moses is in a tremendous anguish, a great turmoil. He had not thought that this is going to happen. He was not deceiving his people. He was very sincere. His intention was good. There was no way to get these people out of Egyptian slavery unless they are given a great hope that pulls them out of slavery. But this happens to all great leaders. When they succeed, then comes the moment of their failure. It happened in India. Mahatma Gandhi led the country for 40 years. And made the people believe that independence comes and all your problems are solved. There will be no poverty, no suffering, no riots, no violence. These Hindu Mohammedan riots in which thousands of people are killed, burned alive. These are created by the British rulers. It was easy to dump it on the British rulers. Everything to dump on the British rulers. You are suffering because you are under slavery. You are poor because they are exploiting. You can never live a respectable life if you are under the shoes of British Empire. People believed him just the same way as Jews had believed Moses. They followed him. The independence came. And that was the great moment of failure for Mahatma Gandhi. Because it is not such a simple affair that just by getting rid of British rule, all your problems will disappear. Your problems are millions of years old. Britishers have been in India only for 300 years. Before that you were poor, hungry, uneducated. In fact, the British Empire did everything to raise the standard of life in India. It introduced all kinds of technology, science, in every possible way, introduced medicine, schools. But nobody is going to think who is going to thank the person who is enslaving you? They are the causes of all the riots, of all the murders, of all the butchery. So people were waiting that as the British go back, we will be living for the first time as human beings. There will be no poverty. Life will be a bed of roses. But life not only remained the same, it became worse. Because the British rulers knew how to rule. In 300 years, they have created a system to control, to keep discipline. Now all that disappeared with them. And the people who came into power had no idea what power is. What to do with power? How to use it? And suddenly a tremendous outburst of violence as India has never seen before, perhaps no other country has seen ever before. Gandhi was settled. Now the Britishers are gone, but the violence is million times more. Because the Britishers had a certain discipline, power, and they have managed the country for 300 years. Now there was nobody. Everybody was free to do whatsoever he wanted. Thousands of people were killed, burnt, trains burnt, completely stopped and burnt. And nobody was allowed to get out of the trains. Houses were on fire. The whole country was in a mess. In Pakistan, the Hindus were being killed. In India, the Mohammedans were being killed. And the leaders were at a loss what to do. Gandhi himself said that now nobody listens to me. And he has been for 40 years the absolute leader of the people. His voice was the voice of the country. And now he says, nobody listens to me. I have become a false coin, useless. He used to say before India became independent that he would like to live for 125 years. Because after independence, there will be real life. Right now, what life is? But as the country became independent and the whole country was on fire, violence everywhere, destruction everywhere, even his own followers, intimate followers, no more listening to him. He said for the first time that now I don't want to live 125 years. Perhaps when Nathuram Godse sought him, he must have felt relief. Because he was carrying a burden. He could not show his face to people. There was no answer. The same was the situation before Moses. He went into the mountains just out of the crowd because they were continuously torturing him, asking him, where is the promised land? We don't see any promised land. Days pass, we don't come across an oasis. People are dying of thirst. And whenever we come across an oasis, it is not easy to get food either. Because they were all poor people, they had no money. They were slaves, they were not paid. And whatsoever they had brought, small things. That caravan of Moses is worth remembering what people had carried with them. Somebody was carrying his donkey. Somebody was carrying a cart. Somebody was carrying few earthen pots. Few clothes. There was nothing valuable. They had nothing. And on the way, they sold whatsoever they had brought with them. These small things. They sold for bread. Moses must have been in terrible pain. Nobody has thought about it. I have never come across a Jewish book pondering over the situation of Moses. He went into the mountains not to meditate. That is a great luxury. Moses cannot afford it. And that was not the time to meditate. He had gone just to avoid this crowd and sit for a time being to think out a plan. Something has to be done. Otherwise, he will be responsible for this whole race dying. And he had promised them. And remember always, this is how human mind works. When you start promising, you forget that there is a limit. Don't exaggerate. Mind is very easily capable of exaggerating. It enjoys exaggerating. It magnifies things both the ways. Just a little pain and it makes so much fuss about it. Just a little suffering and it becomes the greatest suffering in the world. Just a little pleasure and you are on the top of the whole world. Nobody knows what pleasure is. You fall in love with a woman and you think, never before such a love has happened. And never again it is going to happen. This is unique. And this is happening everywhere and everybody is thinking it. This is unique. Mind exaggerates everything, magnifies. It is a magnifier. and you believe it. Moses' people were really in trouble. It was not a question of magnifying. And there is a limit to give them consolation that wait just a little more and we are coming closer, coming closer. It seemed as if they are going farther and farther. There seems to be no signs of coming closer. In this state of anguish, in the burning, hot desert, on the mountain, even more hot, because a desert mountain has no trees, no greenery. He hallucinates. In such a state of mind, anybody can hallucinate. He starts talking to God. His human mind finds no answer. This is a state of hallucination. With open eyes, he is seeing a dream. And he believes that God has given him advice, 10 commandments, that these are the 10 rules. Go to your people and give these 10 commandments. If they follow these 10 commandments, everything will be all right. His hallucination is not a religious experience. There is no God in the first place. Even if there is, he does not speak Hebrew. How you started thinking that God is a Jew? If there is a God and he comes to know that you call him a Jew, do you think he will be happy? But there is no God at all. So there is no problem. It is not Moses alone who is hallucinating. Other religious leaders, of course, so-called religious leaders, have done the same. He comes with great authority. And tells to his people that God has given these 10 commandments. If you live accordingly, fulfilling God's desire, then only you are going to find the promised land. But first you have to be capable of it, worthy of it. Now, this is a good strategy. Neither those poor people can be worthy of fulfilling all those 10 commandments, nor they can ask again, where is the promised land? I don't think that he was being a politician, but who knows? It is good political strategy to give people a certain idea that you fulfill it. If you don't fulfill it, then you are responsible. Then you cannot blame me. I had told you before that these 10 commandments have to be fulfilled. And those 10 commandments cannot be fulfilled by any natural human being. The very structure is such that you will find it going against your natural instincts, your biology, your physiology, your psychology. So rather than blaming the leader, you will start feeling guilty that it is because of you, the promised land is not being reached. I do not think at all that Moses is a religious man. He is a great revolutionary. And certainly a charismatic leader, not of an ordinary caliber, superb. It is not easy to keep 40 years people wandering in the desert and still keeping their hope alive. This was a great strategy, knowingly or unknowingly. My feeling is that it was unknowingly. He certainly had the feeling that God has spoken to him, that he has seen the God. That these 10 commandments are from him. And by giving these commandments to the Jews, he has proved again that Jews are the chosen people of God. You ask me, have I any commandments for you? First, the very word commandment to me is ugly. It is okay for a commander in the army to give commandments. The very word means that you have to follow it. There is no question to be raised, a commandment cannot be doubted. And a commandment from God, you have to fulfill it. And a commandment from God gives Moses the authority to keep these people quiet, disciplined, under his rule. I am not a commander. And I don't want anybody to be under my authority. I do not represent any god whatsoever, Jew, Hindu, Mohammedan, Christian. I am nobody's representative. I simply represent myself. And any authority that I have is mine own. I can say to you authoritatively what my experience is, but I cannot be authoritative to you. Note the difference. Whatsoever I say with authority of my own experience. But I am not being authoritative to you. When I say, believe me, then I start becoming authoritative to you. Don't doubt me. That if you believe, then the paradise is yours. If you doubt, you fall in heaven. You fall in hell. I do not promise you any heaven. I do not make you afraid of any hell. Yes, my words have an intrinsic authority, but they are not authoritative. They don't enslave you. So, of course, I cannot give you any commandments. That will be insulting you. That will be humiliating you. That will be taking your integrity, your freedom, your responsibility from you. No, I cannot commit such a criminal act. I can request you. I can invite you to share with me my experience. I can become the host for you, and you be the guest. It is an invitation, a welcome. But it is not a commandment. What requests I can make to you? It will look a little strange, because Moses, Jesus, Muhammad, Krishna, Mahavir, Buddha, nobody requests you. They all have orders for you. Follow or fall into hell. They don't give you any chance even to think. They reduce your very existence, very being, into an object. They reduce you just like a number in the army. They don't respect your individuality. Hence, I see something irreligious in all those people. They are special. Somebody is special because he has seen God with his own eyes. Now, in what way you can be equal to him? On what right you can question him? He has seen God himself, talked to him, has brought the message for you. He is the messenger. Somebody is the only begotten son. Now what can you do about it? You cannot be equal to Jesus. All that you can do is to follow, to imitate, to be a psychological slave, which is a far more dangerous slavery than any other. Economic slavery is nothing compared to the psychological slavery. I am reminded of Diogenes. I love this fellow Diogenes. For the simple reason that he does not claim any authority from God. He does not give any orders and commandments and disciplines to others. He used to live naked. Not for any religious reason, not to get to heaven. He was not concerned about heaven and hell at all. He lived naked because he says, that's how I was born. Nature wants me to be this way. Why should I be otherwise? I am going to be just natural. One day it happened, he was just going to the river. He used to carry up to that time a begging bowl, which he used to collect food or to keep water. He was running towards the river. He was thirsty. And just by his side, a dog came running and reached before him to the river and started drinking water. Diogenes is great. This dog is far more independent than me. He threw the begging bowl into the river and said to the dog, "Master, you have really shown me the way. I was carrying that weight unnecessarily." He was caught by a few thieves, because in those days people were caught and sold as slaves, and he looked very promising. He was very healthy and has a certain personality. They were certain that they will get great money if they can keep hold of him. They were three, he was alone, but they were not certain that even three will be able to keep hold of him. He may kill all the three. So they followed him, afraid whether to try or just drop the idea, because he seems to be dangerous. And who knows, he may be mad because he is walking naked and enjoying so much, and he has nothing to enjoy. Diogenes was listening what they were thinking and talking, and he said, "Don't be worried. You want to steal me? You want to sell me in the marketplace? They were shocked. They said, "There is trouble. If we say yes, he is going to jump on us." But Diogenes says, "Don't be afraid. I am going myself to the market. You can come with me. You can sell me." "One thing I know, nobody can make me a slave. So you will get money and you will be happy. And I know for certain that nobody can make me a slave. So why should I be worried about it? You just come along with me." They could not even say that we don't want to come along, because this man seems to be so strange. He may force them to come along with him. So they said, "Okay, if you say, then we will come along." He was walking ahead and they were behind him, and he was looking like an emperor and they were looking like slaves. When they reached to the slave market, he stood up on the platform where slaves used to be put, so people can see from all the sides, measure, weight, look at their teeth, just the way you purchase a horse or a bull, that's how they can see your muscles, whether you are strong or weak, old or young. But these three thieves could not say to Diogenes that, please stand on the platform. He jumped himself. And what he said from the platform is something to be remembered. He said, listen, so loudly that the whole market became silent, seeing a naked man and so healthy, so beautiful, so proportionate. They have never seen such a slave. There was great silence in the whole market. All people gathered there. And Diogenes said that for the first time, a master is for sale. Any slave out of you can purchase the master. But remember, you are purchasing a master. Those three thieves were hiding in the crowd because they thought the crowd may become angry and they may be caught that you have brought this man here. But one rich man fell in love. Just the idea. This man is saying a master is for sale. Any slave can purchase it. This rich man asked, who owns you? He said, of course I own. But I have promised three thieves, so money will go to them. They are hiding there. They have followed me. I have forced them really to come here. They were trying to escape from the middle, and just now they are trying to disappear in the crowd. They are the three. You will have to give the money to these people, and I will come with you. As far as ownership is concerned, I own myself and nobody can own me. The rich man said, that's what has appealed me. I am not taking you as a slave. I am accepting you as a master. You just come with me. Just your being in my house is enough. Your presence. The thieves were paid. Diogenes went into the chariot of the rich man. And the rich man certainly behaved as if he is the slave and Diogenes is the master. There is a certain phenomenon. If you are really independent psychologically, nobody can make you a slave. Yes, You can be killed, but you cannot be made a slave. And all these people who have been giving commandments, disciplines, showing you the way how to live, what to eat, what to wear, what to do, what not to do, all these people are in some way trying to make you a psychological slave. I cannot call these people religious. To me, religion begins with psychological freedom. I cannot give you commandments, but I can give you few requests. Nobody has done it before, so it may look a little outlandish, but what can I do? I can give you few invitations. My first request or invitation is don't let your doubt die. That is the most precious thing you have got. Because it is doubt that is going one day to help you discover the truth. And all these people say believe, their first thing is destroy your doubt. Start with faith, because if you don't start with faith, then on each step you will raise questions. Hence, I would like it to be my first request to you. Doubt until you discover. Do not believe until you come to know yourself. Once you believe, you will never be able to know on your own. Belief is poison. Most dangerous poison there is, because it kills your doubts. It kills your inquiry. It takes away from you your most precious instrument. Whatsoever science has achieved in 300 years is through doubt. And in 10,000 years, religion has achieved nothing because of its belief. You can see, anybody who has eyes can see, that in 300 years, science has achieved so much. In spite of all the hindrances created by the religious people, what has been the basic power of science? It was doubt. Doubt doubt and go on doubting till you come to a point that you cannot doubt anymore. And you cannot doubt anymore only when you come to know something on your own. Then there is no question of doubt. There is no way to doubt. So this is my first request. My second request, never imitate. The mind is an imitator. Because imitation is very easy. To be someone is very difficult. To become someone is very easy. All that you need is to be a hypocrite, which is not much of a great problem. Deep down you remain the same, but on the surface you go on painting yourself according to some image. The Christian is trying to become like the Christ. That's what the word Christian means. You would love to be like Christ. You are on the way, maybe far away, but moving slowly. A Christian means a person trying slowly to become a Christ. A Mohammedan means a person trying to become Muhammad. But unfortunately, this is not possible. This is not in the very nature of universe. It only creates unique beings. It has no idea at all of carbon copies, duplicators, cyclostyle material. Existence has no idea, just the original. And each individual is so unique and original that if he tries to become Christ, he is committing suicide. If he tries to become a Buddha, he is committing suicide. So the second request is, don't imitate. If you want to know who you are, please avoid imitation. That's a way of avoiding to know yourself. I have always loved Friedrich Nietzsche's one statement. And in many different contexts, I have found it mysteriously true. Again, in this reference, Nietzsche says the first and the last Christian died 2000 years before on the cross. The first and the last. Now all others are just dodos. They are trying in every way to be Christian. And it is not possible at all. It is not allowed by existence and its laws. You cannot change the universal laws. You can only be yourself. And nothing else. And it is beautiful to be yourself. Anything original has beauty, freshness, fragrance, aliveness. Anything that you imitate is dead, dull, phony, plastic. You can pretend, but whom you are deceiving? Except yourself, you are not deceiving anybody else. And what is the point of deceiving? What you are going to gain? These same religious people, Moses, Mahavir, Buddha, these same religious people have been telling you, if you imitate exactly the lines prescribed by them, you will attain to great pleasure in heaven, in paradise. They all have been somehow enforcing your greed, lust. They talk of desirelessness. And for what? Can you see the contradiction of all these religions? They say drop desiring so that you can attain to paradise. And what is this if not desiring? This is the greatest desire. What other desires you are dropping for it? Wearing beautiful clothes, drop it. Having a beautiful house, drop it. Eating good food, drop it. These are desires. These are small things. And what you are going to gain in return? The whole paradise is yours. These people are not teaching you desirelessness. On the contrary, they are giving you a great desire in bargain. If you can drop your small, stupid desires, and because of that great desire, you are ready to imitate, because that's the only way to reach there. You are ready to imitate. Thousands of people are living even today on the guidelines of Buddha. They may have been good for Gautam Buddha. He may have enjoyed it. I have no quarrel about it. But he was not imitating anybody. That you don't see at all. Is Christ trying to imitate anybody? If you have just a little intelligence, very little intelligence, that will do. Not that you need genius to understand simple fact. Whom Christ has imitated, whom Buddha has imitated, whom Lao Tzu has imitated, nobody. And that's why they have flowers. But you are imitating. The first thing to learn is that non-imitation is one of the fundamentals of religious life. Don't be a Christian and don't be a Mohammedan and don't be a Hindu. So that you can discover who you are. Before discovering, you start covering yourself with all kinds of labels. And then you go on reading those labels and thinking, this is you, you are a Mohammedan, you are a Christian. And those are labels glued upon you by yourself. Are. By your parents, by your well-wishers. They are all your enemies. Whosoever tries you to distract from your being is your enemy. This is my definition. Whosoever helps you to remain determinedly whatsoever the cost, whatever the consequence, remain yourself. He is your friend. I am not a messiah. I am not a prophet. I am only a friend. And a friend cannot do what you are asking me to do. What commandments I can give you? No, none. I cannot tell you what to do and what not to do. I can only explain to you that either you can be yourself or you can try and pretend to be somebody else. That trying and pretending is easier because you are just acting. Now, in this film of Lord Attenborough's Gandhi, the man who is acting as Gandhi, what do you think? He's doing perfectly well. he looks like Gandhi. Attenborough had to go around the world to find a man who looks like Gandhi. It is very difficult. And this man simply walked into his office and he said, "What? I have been searching all over." And he was just a poor actor in some small drama company. He looks like Gandhi. He wears the clothes like Gandhi. He walks like Gandhi. He talks like Gandhi. What more you want? But do you think he has become Gandhi? Sometimes he can manage even to be better than Gandhi. Because Gandhi was doing it for the first time, he is doing it second time. He can drop all the mistakes and faults. He can improve upon. It has happened Charlie Chaplin's friends on his 50th birthday had a special arrangement to celebrate. All over England, people were invited to play the part of Charlie Chaplin. From villages, they will be chosen, then there will be a competition on another level, district, then there will be another competition higher, and then the final competition will be in London. Charlie Chaplin was a joker, and he said, "This is a good time to play a joke." So by the back door, he entered into the competition. But the joke turned upon him. He came second. Somebody else came first. Judges were not aware that Charlie Chaplin himself is playing. It became known only later on that he has come second as Charlie Chaplin. Somebody else has gone farther in being Charlie Chaplin. So it is possible a Christian may go a little ahead than Christ, a Buddhist may go a little ahead than Buddha, but it is still acting. You are only doing it. It is not your being. Keep the distance between being and doing. You can do things against your being. There is no problem. The being is very patient, very calm and quiet. It won't disturb you. If you want to play somebody else's role, it will allow you. But you can get... Now this man who came better than Charlie Chaplin still knows that he is not Charlie Chaplin. His being, it was just acting. And when he discovered that he has gone farther in being Charlie Chaplin than Charlie Chaplin himself, he could not believe. He apologized to Charlie Chaplin that, "Forgive me, I had no idea that you are in the competition." Charlie Chaplin said that, "I was thinking to play a joke, but I became a laughing stock myself. But you have revealed a great truth, that acting and being are two separate things. But in ordinary life, you are not playing a role of being a Christian. You start thinking you are a Christian. Slowly, 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 conditioned by the society, by the parents, by the education, you become a Christian. You completely forget that you were not born as a Christian. And you completely forgot that what was your potential to be. You have moved away into a direction which may not have been your potential. You have gone farther away. You will have to return back. When I say this to people, it hurts. But I cannot do it in any other way. It is going to hurt. You have gone miles in being a Christian. You have to come back miles. And it is going to be a hard task. And unless you come back to the point from where you deviated, you will never be able to discover yourself. And there is all that has to be discovered. My third request is, beware of knowledge. It is so cheap to become knowledgeable. Scriptures are there. Libraries are there. Universities are there. It is so easy to become knowledgeable. And once you become knowledgeable, you are in a very sensitive space. Because the ego would like to believe that this is your knowledge. Not only knowledgeability, it is your wisdom. The ego would like to change knowledge into wisdom. You will start believing that you know. You know nothing. You know only books and what is written in the books. Perhaps those books are written just like by persons like you. 99% books are written by other bookish people. In fact, if you read 10 books, your mind becomes so much full of rubbish that you would like to pour it down into the 11th book. What else you are going to do with it? You have to unburden yourself. Books go on growing. Each year, thousands and thousands of books, each language goes on producing. Never before the danger was so great as it is today. Because never before knowledge was so easily available to you. Through all kinds of media. Now the book is not the only thing. You can get it from the newspaper, from the magazine, from the radio, from television. And these sources will be becoming more and more available. The danger will become more stronger. I have been a professor in 2 universities. And I have watched hundreds of professors. That is the most snobbish tribe in the whole world. The professor thinks himself to be a different species altogether because he knows. And what he knows, just words. And words are not experience. You can go on repeating the word love, love, love millions of times, then too it won't give you the taste of love. But if you read books on love, and there are thousands of books on love, novels and poetries, stories, treatises, theses, and you can come to know about love so much that you may forget completely that you have never loved. That you don't know what love is all about. And you know all about love that is written in the books. So the third thing is to be beware of knowledge. So much alert that whenever you want, you can put your knowledge aside. and it will not block your vision. It will not come between you and reality. You have to go to reality utterly naked. But if there are so many books between you and reality, then whatsoever you will see will not be the real. It will be distorted by your books in so many ways. By the time it reaches to you, it may have no connection at all with the reality. The fourth thing I will not say, pray, because there is no God to pray. I cannot say, like all the religions, that prayer will make you religious. It will give you a bogus religiousness. So in my religion, the word prayer has to be completely dropped. God is not there. Hence, talking to the empty sky is utterly foolish. The danger is you may start hearing voices from the sky, then you have gone beyond the limit of normality, then you are abnormal. Then you are no more capable of doing something. You will need psychiatric treatment. So before that happens, before God answers you, please don't ask. Because that is within your power, not to ask, not to pray. God cannot force you to pray and to ask. If you pray and ask and you insist, He may answer. That is the danger. And once you hear the answer, then you are not going to listen to anybody. Then you have to be forced for a psychiatric treatment. Otherwise, you are going insane. My word for prayer is love. Forget the word prayer. Replace it by love. Love is not for some invisible God. Love is for the visible human beings, animals, trees, oceans, mountains. Spread your wings of love as far and wide as you can. And remember, love needs no belief system. Even the atheist loves. Even the communist loves. Even the materialist loves. So love is something intrinsic to you, nothing imposed from outside that only a Christian can love or a Hindu can love. It is your human potential. And I would like you to depend on your human potential rather than these bogus conditionings of Christian, Jewish, Hindu. You don't bring them with you, but love you bring with you. Part and parcel of your being. Love without any inhibition, without any taboos. All these religions have tabooed love. You can understand the strategy. The strategy is that if your love is tabooed, then your energy of love will start moving towards prayer. That's a simple way. You block the passage of love, it will find some way. Now you have blocked to reach to the real, it will try to reach to the unreal. You have blocked the human possible, now it will try something imaginary, hallucinatory. All the religions are against love because that is the danger. If a man moves into love, he may not bother about the church and the temple and the mosque and the priest. Why he should bother? He may not think at all of prayer because he knows something more substantial, something more nourishing. He knows something more existential. Why he should go into dreams? Just see this way. Fast one day and next morning remember what you dreamt. You will certainly dream of food, feast. Absolutely certain, just fast one day and you will dream in the night. What happened? You drop the real, but your whole being wants it. If you drop the real, then the only way possible is to have the substitute, the unreal. Whatever you dream, keep check on it. That dream indicates what you are living in reality. A man who lives in reality, his dreams start disappearing. There is nothing to dream for him. By the time he goes to sleep, he is finished with the work of the day. He is finished. He has no hangover that moves into dreams. Sigmund Freud, Jung, Adler, all these people have been working on dreams. They should have looked at least in one person's life where dreams have disappeared, and that would have given them the clue. But these people are just as stupid as you are. Freud was so much afraid of ghosts that you cannot believe. You are not afraid that much of ghosts. Jung was thrown out of the psychoanalytic movement for the simple reason because he believed in ghosts. And one day, when Sigmund Freud and Jung were sitting in Freud's sitting room, Jung started talking about ghosts. He was very much interested about ghosts. And just when he started talking about ghosts, there was a great explosion in the cupboard. Freud fell from his seat. And he said, "I have told you again and again. Talk of the devil and he is there. But you don't listen." Even Jung was shaken. They opened the cupboard, there was nothing. How so much noise, as if a bomb has exploded. He closed the cupboard and they sat again, and again they started talking about the ghost, because how can you stop so suddenly after such an experience? And again there was the explosion. And that was the last. After that, Freud never saw Jung. He was so much afraid of death that you could not have talked about death. His disciples were made aware, particularly the new ones, that never mention the word death. Because twice it has happened, people had mentioned something about death and he fell on the ground. In a fit, he became unconscious. He was so much afraid of death, even the word death was enough to make him unconscious. And these people are giving you psychoanalysis. These are your great scientists of the mind. Jung was afraid of dead bodies. And this is a natural law of whatsoever you are afraid, you are fascinated too. So he wanted to go to Egypt to see the ancient mummies, those dead bodies which have been preserved in the pyramids and now they are in the museums of Egypt. He wanted to go many times. The tickets were booked. Sometimes he reached even to the airport but became nervous. So nervous, so feverish, that came back again, canceled the trip. He never managed to reach to Egypt, but he tried a dozen times to reach to Egypt, and always he became nervous. Just the idea of seeing 3, 4, 5 thousand-year-old dead body and something inside him just freaked out. These people have not known a single person whose dreams have disappeared. For example, I cannot dream even if I want to. There is no way. I have tried and failed. I have tried many ways, invented, because there is no book which says how to create dreams. So I invented my own ways that I will go into sleep thinking of something, visualizing something, that as I am going into sleep, whatsoever I am visualizing may remain in the sleep and it will become a dream. But as sleep comes, I was visualizing that disappears. Sleep is there, but what I was visualizing is not there. If you live your real life authentically, sincerely, totally, dreams are finished. If you love, you will never think of prayer. Because you know the real thing, then why you should go after the pseudo? And all these religions were aware that it stopped the real, so you have to go to the pseudo. The fifth thing I would like to say to you, that live moment to moment. Go on dying every moment about the past. It is finished. There is no need even to label it good or bad. Only thing to know is it is finished. It is no more. It is going to be no more. Gone and gone forever. Now why waste time about it? Never think of the past, because you are wasting the present, which is the only real thing in your hands. And never think of the future, because nobody knows how tomorrow is going to be, what tomorrow is going to be, how it is going to turn up. Where you are going to land, you cannot imagine. Do you think about what happened to our commune? Have you ever thought that we are going to land in Oregon in America? I don't think anybody howsoever dreaming and imaginary and hallucinatory had thought of Oregon, but we landed here. This goes on happening every day. You don't take note of it, that yesterday you wasted so much time thinking for this day, and it has not turned out to be according to your ideas and your plans and this and that. And now you are worried that why you wasted that time. Again you are wasting. Remain in the moment, true to the moment, utterly here now, as if there has been no yesterday and there is going to be no tomorrow. Only then you can be here now, totally. And that totality of being in the present joins you with the existence, because existence knows no past, no future. It is always here now. Existence knows only one tense, that is present tense. It is language which creates three tenses and creates 3,000 tenses in your mind. The present knows only one tense, and that is present. And it is not a tension at all. It is utterly relaxing. When you are totally here, no yesterday is pulling you back, no tomorrow is pulling you somewhere else. You are relaxed. To me, to be in the moment is meditation. To be utterly in the moment. And then it is so beautiful. So fragrant. So fresh. It never gets old. It never goes anywhere. It is we who come and pass. Existence remains as it is. It is not time that passes. It is we who come and pass. But it is a fallacy to us that rather than seeing that we are passing, we have created a great invention, the clock. Time passes. Just think, if there is no man on the earth, will there be any time passing? Things will be all there. The ocean will still be coming to the beach. Pressing its waves on the rocks. The sun will rise. The sun will set, but there will be no morning, there will be no evening. There will be no time as such. Time is a mind invention. And basically, time can exist with yesterdays and tomorrows. The present moment is not part of time. When you are simply here, just now, there is no time. You are breathing, you are alive, you are feeling, you are open to everything that is happening all around. When your each moment starts becoming meditation, you are religious. So these five requests for you.
The word content and voice recording on this audio format are the copyright of Osho International Foundation. Copyright dates 1953 through 2003. All rights reserved. Reproduction in any media is prohibited.